This is the AdNonTech Podcast, conversations about education, technology, and culture, with Dr. Doug Reed and Dr. Matt Stranick. Thank you for joining us.
My name is Dr. Doug Reed, and I am located in Abigwe, the traditional and unceded territory of the Mi'kmaq people.
My name is Dr. Matthew Stranick, and I am located at Manakwisk in St. John, New Brunswick, which is situated on the traditional and unceded territory of the Wolastoqiyik Maliseet people. Everybody, wherever you may be, it is the AdNonTech show. With us as ever, myself, Matt Stranick, and the inestimable and sports-clad Dr. Doug Reed.
Hey, thanks, Matt.
Yeah, man. How are things?
They're going okay. The score of the hockey game last night was a little disappointing for a lot of Canadians.
How badly did they get beat, I've got to ask?
It was 3-0, so it wasn't that bad. There was an empty net goal, but there was nothing they could do. It was Florida could have just put a giant piece of plywood in front of the net.
Okay.
The goalie was just so good. It was interesting.
Well, I mean, that's the thing, though. It's a game of feet and inches is what I've heard, and so seven-game series, somebody had to lose the first one, so hopefully gives them a greater motivation to really show how much they want it in the next game, right? That's tomorrow night, I think?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
I only have, so for the listeners, I've got an Edmonton Oilers jersey that was a gift from my mom's, or no, my, the sort of the adoptive grandmother of my wife, and an Oilers ball cap from when I went to a game there, because I used to live out there for years and years and years. And the only thing that can make this podcast more typically Canadian, if we start talking about the weather now, that would be the next thing.
Well, I mean, it is a glorious summer day here in my part of the Maritimes, just because it is. And
we've got some mist, which is nice, because I'm going to go plant in my garden after this. And I'd rather do that in a coolish temperature rather than just the sun beating down on me. So it's great for me.
Yeah, you with all your like outdoorsy kind of activities. That's commendable. Commendable from those of us who, you know, aren't. So, Doug, tell me what we're talking about today.
This is all mental health stuff. It's get outside, be in the nature. It's just better for you. And today, what I want to talk about is the exact opposite. I want to talk about the danger of too much technology in education. That's
okay.
Where I think we need to go.
All right. Well, that's first of all, I completely agree with your aspect of being outside for mental health. Certainly, you know, I mean, I don't drive, right? So my whole default thing is like, anytime I go, it's like I can just about any place. It's like I can wait for a bus, you know, within the city, obviously, not town to town. I can wait for the bus, or I mean, in most cities, I can just walk wherever I'm going to go. And to me, that's just a way better use of my time and energy, and certainly beneficial to the mental health aspect for sure. So I hear you there. And yeah, man, I guess I do want to ask, in as much as we've dealt with, I don't know, various aspects of things over the show, this one to me strikes me as almost a bit dystopian in nature, hence my AI-generated background, right? This is, I asked the AI to generate a dystopic road to ruin kind of cityscape, and it was very happy to oblige. So thank you to our AI soon to be overlords, I suppose. So what's the impetus, though?
Okay, before I get to the impetus, I thought that was an AI generated picture of Edmonton the day after they don't win the Stanley Cup.
Oh boy, like in Vancouver.
Yeah, like what happened to Vancouver.
A decade and change ago, right? Wow. Mm-hmm. Show them what we're made of, Canada. That's overturned cars, charges. We're not. Totally, bro.
So this topic came up because I was sitting having a chat with my wife, and she's been an educator since her early 20s. And we were talking about, I think about doing this, I think about doing that. And she goes, why not just do enough's enough? But talk about what happens when there's just too much technology. And I could hear the emotion in her voice. And I had just talked to another friend of mine who's currently teaching grade 12 English. And she's like, if you think AI is bad in post-secondary, it's worse in K-12, because the kids that are just trying to get through, the kids that know they're not going to college, they know they're not going to university, they just want to get done grade 12, some of them are just pumping into ChatGPT or one of the other Baron or whatever the AIs are, and just, there you go, my English essay's done, because it's jumping through a hoop for them, and this is a tool that'll help them do it. So when's enough enough?
K-12, that's an interesting sort of case that you've mentioned there, because it's always like I've had almost all of my experience in a higher education or adult learning kind of setting. So, you're just, it's easy to forget that something like only, fewer than half of Canadians actually attend any kind of post-secondary at all, right?
Yeah.
So, for the other half who just kind of know that they're not going to go or whatever, it's like, where's the implicit motivation? With adult students, it's like it's tied very tangibly to employment outcomes and perhaps enhanced personal and life opportunities. So even if someone's just kind of there filling a seat for a few years, it's still preferable to whatever other alternative they could envision. But again, for the majority of Canadians, and if you look at the States, it's even worse, right? There's such a greater disparity between people who become post-secondary educated and not. I feel for our K-12 colleagues is all I'll wind that one down with, pal. That's for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And another part of the difference between K-12 and post-secondary is especially in a lot of the college systems that I have experience in, the students aren't coming right from high school. There's a gap there. The students are finishing high school and then they're doing stuff. And then in their 20s and 30s, they're saying, wow, I need a piece of paper. This is not how I want to live the rest of my life. I see it as a goal. I know I was a very different student when I was 32 or 31 starting my master's than I was at 19, 18, 20 when I was an undergrad.
Completely relate to that sentiment, bud. And that actually, it's funny. I think just what you've said, we were pretty much the same age when we went and did our master's degree. In my case, I went directly into post-secondary because I could not fathom anything better to do. Seemed a lot easier than working full-time, even though I was working full-time at a part-time job. But then I got a degree, which in and of itself is not considered inherently useful, right? An English degree, an arts degree. I wouldn't have done otherwise. I wasn't capable of doing otherwise based on who I am or what I was. But for about 4 or 5 years after, I was in like call centers and I worked in like, you know, the the town newspaper, the Fredericton Daily Gleaner, and like the newspaper packing, you know, facility in the middle of the night, you know, and just factory settings, just every kind of restaurant role you can imagine. And I was like, I'm not sure what I was put here for, but I'm pretty sure it wasn't this. So that drove me very significantly into the career that I'm in now. And however much I struggle with things now, like, you know, periods of unemployment or whatever, it's still, I can't imagine doing otherwise at this point. So anyway, man, I think we've hit on something a lot of people will actually be able to relate to. So bravo, yes. Aaron. Shout out to Aaron on this topic, bro.
Yeah, thanks. I'll let her know.
Totally.
So I've the articles that I want to talk about this week are, there's a different, like, dystopian is a good word, because this first article by Daresh 2006 talks about technology and school leaders, right? Overdue or overload. And it feels utopian. To be honest, this is the one that feels utopian, because it's Daresh is talking about students won't have a full and rich education without being able to develop competence in the use of computers and other forms of technology. And they actually mention computers separately. And yeah, we need to teach them that, because that's what's coming. That's society. Let's be bright and cheery and let's make this happen. And that's 18 years ago that we could be positive about it.
Well, you think about that. It's funny, just because I appreciate the positive framing of that. Certainly, that's always a position you can work from, a positive proposition as opposed to enumerating negatives, right? So that's absolutely legit. The first thing that kind of jumped in my brain just looking at that was this notion of digital literacy, and how, like, again, to speak to being able to make any kind of living in the quote unquote knowledge economy, I mean, everything that Daresh is saying here is true and then some, I think, because I mean, really, we've gone, okay, so Canada's so-called a natural resource economy, but I mean, the North American model, since really NAFTA was designed to give American firms the opportunity to offshore their labor into Mexico and other, you know, parts of North America, where maybe the labor laws aren't as stringent, where maybe they don't have to pay as much, maybe where the exchange on the currency, they save a lot there. So, I mean, as a result, the industrial base has been hollowed out. And, you know, this is not a new thing, but I mean, you wonder where all these weird Trump supporters come from. It's because, like, they used to work in these factory jobs and whatnot, and then they shuttered them. But I mean, it was a Republican, president and a conservative prime minister in Canada who rammed the thing through to satisfy their big interests, who Trump ostensibly represents. So, I mean, it's just utter shenanigans. So in order to participate in the post-industrial economy, digital literacy, dudes, learn to use a computer. Your kids do. It's a challenge for some people.
Yeah. And it's, there's a difference between using a computer to play a video game or putting a console device in and playing whatever the latest and greatest Call of Duty or Fortnite or whatever the latest game is, and using it productively to help enrich your life and help enrich the lives of others. And this was right at the beginning of when the internet was, and devices were starting to really take things over in classrooms. Because before 2006, when I was teaching, if I wanted to touch a computer, I went to another room. I went to the computer lab, because there might be one lone computer at the back. Was it networked to the internet? Probably not. And if I wanted all the students to do something, right, it's like, oh, okay, I'll huddle around one computer. No, that's not happening. So this was still very optimistic, and here's a direction we have to head, and isn't that great? And so I really like this article. It made me feel good starting off with this, because we're going to slide closer to dystopian for the next ones that are coming up.
Indubitably. And to that effect, you've got a pretty significant chunk here from Cias de Lerde.
Yes. And so we jump ahead 7 years to 2013, and now we're talking about education overload. And that's what's happened. It's been 7 years. Has teacher education changed in that 7 years? Not really, because I know a bunch of faculties of education that don't have ed tech programs because, oh, we don't need it. We know how to plug the computer into the overhead, right? I know how to log into Moodle. So that's all the ed tech we need. So this big tsunami of change has hit the education sector, and the training hasn't really changed, right? Like the words that, like, mass communication, big data, right? Indiscriminate proliferation of information.
Right? That's good. I like that. Yeah.
Me too. That was one of the reasons I grabbed one of these quotes, was because this is how they're starting to describe the educational pattern that's coming. And it's always been the same, right? A change comes in and it gets dumped on the frontline teachers as they deal with it. And sometimes there's some help, but is there an ongoing tail of professional development? Or is it, here you go, here's the new initiative for September, or here's the new initiative for the summer, figure it out. And teachers are victims of our own success. We've been good at that. We've been good at rolling with it. Like, look at what happened with COVID. Teachers rolled with it. Suddenly, everything's online. Like, out of the blue, the pandemic pivot happens, and teachers rolled with it, and somehow they made it through.
Well, it becomes a matter for public education. Certainly, it's really like what taxpayers are expecting from K-12 and from post-secondary, because most post-secondary institutions in Canada are mostly publicly funded, is we don't want to give you anything more for resources. We'd much rather give you less. Just do as much as you possibly can, and then some, on as little resources as possible. So, I mean, all these grants and programs that were rolled out during the pivot to provide support, the pivot, Jesus. Anyway, it's just like, don't expect that to be permanent, friends. And don't, and P.S., we're gonna, you know, offload a few auxiliary positions. We'll lose a few music teachers, you know, maybe drop drama or hire only half of a phys ed teacher. And it's just, education is just one of those things. It's like, people bitch about adding resources to it to the extent that you need. And I quite agree with your point that you mentioned ed tech programs. And at first I thought you were sort of onto places where people can actually train in a post-secondary environment in ed tech as a legitimate discipline within an educational program of study. And that would be very, because to my knowledge, there really aren't too many. Athabasca's doing it. There's probably a few others. University of Calgary has since changed its terminology towards the learning sciences. But it's just, if you want people who are skilled and knowledgeable to act as educators, but also practitioners in K-12 and in higher ed, having more of these programs with specializations at the bachelor's level, even not just at the master's, is probably something you want to do. But again, that takes thinking 5 years ahead, which you can't do if you're constantly worrying about your funding being halved or removed or whatever from year to year, and you have to just justify the bare scraps that you're even getting in the first place. Again, sorry, dude, total tirade mode today.
No, along that line, your comments reminded me of a few years ago, a couple of years before I met my wife. I was in Edmonton and talking to a friend of mine, and there had been a research study in their school district. And the research study was, oh, let's implement this. It wasn't that one laptop per kid, or it wasn't Chromebooks. It was whatever one of those little buzzy word things were. And it was a top down. The people in charge of the school district gave these computers to these teachers, and it was some kind of laptop thing. And I was like, hey, so how did that go? And I got 20 minutes of venom from how did it go? Because it was a dumped on the teacher. It was that one more thing, and it was rubbish. It didn't help. It made everything worse. It added to the workload. The students didn't learn. Right? Like, you know, the tirade.
Don't buy it if you can't afford to support it, administrators. How about that? Honestly.
And that's it.
Yeah.
So that was that, right? Whatever, right? That was a conversation. About 2 months later, 3 months later, I was talking to somebody at a university out there who happened to be, like, peripherally involved in the project.
Oh.
And so I'm having tea, she's having coffee, and we're having that conversation. And she's like, oh, yeah, I just published this research out of this school district. I'm like, oh, I know that school district. I used to do some stuff for them. And it's like, oh, yeah. And then she describes the research, and it's glowing. And she's like, oh, yeah, do you want to take a look? Here's where we're going to publish it. And I'm like, why would you publish a failed project? And she's like, what do you mean failed? This was a massive success. Look, it did this and this and this and this. And I'm like, your data's wrong. I said, because I've talked to people on the ground, and none of that is true. None of it. So I don't know where you got your information, but that is not true. Well, you read my paper. So she sent me the paper, and I read it. It was like, oh, my God. Like, was there a huge, massive difference between the reality and what was getting written up? And I was like, oh, this is – and this person wasn't an ed tech. They were an assessment person, not an ed tech person. They're like, oh, well, you're looking at it through the wrong lens. I'm like, the lens I'm looking through is let's help the students, and let's help the students by helping the teachers. And it didn't. It's a disaster. We need to take a wooden stake and pound a stake into the heart of that thing, right? And make sure that never comes back. Yeah. So we basically never had a conversation after that.
You got away with words when you want to, Doug. you do know how to certainly coin an image. I guess, first of all, you know, kudos to engaging, you know, in dialogue with both, you know, sides of that. I definitely think that researcher, I won't call it bias, because people know methods and, you know, they have,
yeah.
I'm sure the methodology within the study, without having actually looked at it, was sound, because otherwise, you know,
right,
technical issues within the research study would be flagged within peer review, right? I mean, that's the purpose of peer review. But then you get to the interpretation part, and if you are looking at the interpretation, then did it satisfy the objectives of the technological intervention from a technical standpoint? It's quite a different set of questions than did it enrich student learning? Was there, you know, something to do the effect of enhancing educational self-efficacy among the teacher cohort or the student cohort? And I mean, some people, I mean, that's just like, well, I mean, that's just airy fairy qualitative, you know, stuff. But as you say, that can be the truth on the ground compared to the higher level overview by a post-secondary researcher, possibly making over $100,000 a year, possibly
way more than 100,
possibly with a tenured role wherein they don't have to do anything except research, or, you know, teach only the keenest of the keen, you know, graduate students or upper undergraduate seminars. So yeah, the divide between the academy and the room, the kids, the students, is very vast sometimes, and for sure that's probably a problem within the wider body of that, of educational literature, I would even say. Again, just anecdotally based on my own experience and prejudices, I suppose, but nevertheless.
Yeah, and I'm probably overstating a bit, I have no doubt. Right, as soon as I talk about wooden stakes, I'm sure I'm overstating things. But the fact that it didn't work is fine. Absolutely, yeah. Published that. We headed down that path. It didn't work. But when you add phrases like the community thought or the teachers said, it's like, I know those things aren't true. I know it. But I also know that this person on tenure track or with tenure needs to get a couple of more lines at the end of the resume to publish.
And if you really, we're kind of going a little bit sideways here, but I mean, you've mentioned it on this show before. I remember you mentioned this, you know, quite a while ago. I mean, it might've even been like the first year of the thing. Like you quoted a statistic on the show once about how few people actually read an academic paper. So for this researcher, it's like, well, it's going to go through peer review. I'm going to get my thing on my resume. The people in, you know, who were my participants aren't even going to read it, even if it's made available. Really, I mean, the average, you know, it's something like fewer than 40 people will ever read any given peer-reviewed article.
Eight.
What? Eight? Jesus, it's worse than I thought.
The last bit of research I read said it was between 6 and 8 people on average read a peer-reviewed article that gets published.
It's almost like lack of accountability, and what you described again, where something's not true. Let's maybe just sort of differentiate between what may be technically, factually accurate based on cherry-picking data compared to what is true, to give them the benefit of, you know, your colleague, the benefit of carrying out research that evolved from a flawed set of premises and or questions, resulting in documenting a dumpster fire, but then not having the sense of self-efficacy as a researcher to call a dumpster fire a dumpster fire.
And this is impacting what technology is getting pushed into
Correct.
The educational environments. Because if you're near a big institution, there are researchers saying, hey, let me come do this, or would you like to partner with that? That happens, right? And that's great. I think that's a fantastic way to go. But when we're leading some of these things up, like the very next article I have ties into this, and it's Carr, Wisniewski, and Liu, 2010, when more is too much.
That is an awesome graphic with that one, bro.
That's why I grabbed this one.
Good Lord.
They have a great graphic. It's about technology overload and the law of diminishing marginal returns. And one part of the grid is productivity, and the other part is how much technology. And it makes this really ugly hill where, we can leverage the technology. It's good. And now we're in overload and everything plummets.
Dude, before I forget it, it reminds me of like a bastardized version of the thing for Rogers' Diffusion of Innovations. Like, it's just like, here's the evil side of it, folks. Whatever, you know. Evil.
Yes.
I mean, nothing's inherently evil, but certainly things can be inherently fucked. I mean, pardon my French, but man, that's an awesome graphic. I love that graphic. If I hadn't just got a Garfield tattoo the other week, I would maybe consider getting that instead on my forearm.
So for the listeners, go to the website analogtrope.ca/podcast or oios.ca/ent. And the graphic is there that we're raving about. But the language around it, like increased usage of technology tools, doesn't always lead to increased work productivity. Rather, sometimes it can actually be counterproductive. And when we have outside factors pushing on us, because all it's going to take is one administrator or one person in a position of power to grab that dumpster fire article and use that as a justification to do something. And then we're just repeating the cycle.
Dude, deans and people who are higher than deans love to grab the peer-reviewed literature that supports their position. So it's like, you know, I've had experiences with the pharmaceutical industry marginally. My mom, other people in my family have actually been through a lot. So, you know, it's like when you go to go, when you go to a doctor and they're not quite sure what's up, whether it's, you know, cognitive or whatever kind of thing, what they'll give you, like, they'll start you off on, here's the things we can try. And very often the first thing they'll give you is something they're getting, you know, the new thing from the company that they're sponsoring them, right? It's almost, it's like the medical equivalent of getting the thing on the hockey helmet, right? Canadian Tire branded. Here's, you know, Gleaminex, right? It's the most awesome. If anybody's ever watched the Kids in the Hall movie, Brain Candy, Gleaminex. Anyway, and it's like, okay, now I've got headaches, nausea, and I can't stand properly, but what was the problem again? You know, it's that kind of deal. So just these prescriptions, particularly with hardware. I mean, at least with software, yeah, you can end the contract, you know, purge the data, save the data, move on. But yeah, this whole kind of mid, early, late aughts kind of deal, like, let's try clickers. I know we're always beating on clickers. Or smart boards. I mean, God help us all. And it's, and again, I've said this before, and I'm sorry for the tirade, man, but it's just like, it's not even the fact that these interventions failed. It's that all the resources that went into a failed, you know, hardware purchase could have been used to hire a couple of TAs, could have been used to get an extra librarian, you know, on for half the day. Could have you know, maybe a set of musical instruments for an underfunded program. But like, nah, I know a guy who was friends with a vendor who says this is the shit, and he has four different peer back it up. Like, you know, that's kind of my opinion after 18 plus years of this stuff. Anyway, bro, I love that graphic and I love that reference.
Thanks.
Yeah,
and,
man.
And a second part of this article, like when they're talking about leveraging and they're talking about overload, is they also go in and they quote cognitive load theory. And that posits that optimal learning occurs when an individual's working memory is minimized so that long-term memory can be facilitated, because it's tough to do both. You can do one or the other. And if you're in overload, long-term memory is not being facilitated.
Well, it forces you into a fight or flight response just because you're like intimidated on a fundamental level by this tsunami of content. And if you don't have like the skills or aptitude to, or literacies, plural, to kind of pick out the important stuff, or, you know, if you have even a generational history, maybe you're the first person in your family to even, you know, be in institutional education or post-secondary or whatever. So, you know, you just get into a fight or flight response. And as a result of that trauma, right, from trying to have so much content, and this whole notion that like the brilliant ones, the ones who are meant to succeed will. It's like, again, just how about you actually figure something out about how people really learn, visit your teaching and learning center, and try something that doesn't scare the hell and intimidate half your students or more, right? Mm-hmm. Sorry, dude.
no problem. No problem. So I'm going to jump ahead to 2022.
Please.
Razul, Warwick, and Sajid talks about examining the impact of tech overload in the workplace. And so now we've jumped, what, 16 years in the future from our first article, and the optimism is gone. Right? There's no more utopia. At best, we're at dystopia. It's Technology overload is described as Technostrax or Techno Invasion.
Oh,
that
my
is what God. Happened.
We're getting so many good words out of this one, Matt.
Oh, I loved this topic. Right? Then they say technology overload is a new phenomenon in the field of human-computer interactions. It just is. And what are we doing to help the students with this? But throwing more technology at them. So we have all these articles. Some are good. Some are less good, in my humble opinion. And we just keep hammering the teachers with new stuff. Right? And this is, we're post-pandemic pivot. Right? Students are back face-to-face. And what's changed now? AI is the next tsunami coming in to change everything, to change the entire landscape.
I just feel like if your methods to something can be replaced by automation, I struggle with that, with automation, it's like with the car manufacturing sector. I mean, eventually they had the guy stop, you know, on the assembly line. The guy tire on before it rolled off the T4, you know, assembly line. I mean, they replaced that dude, right? They replaced him with a new process, with new machinery, and everybody said, hooray for efficiencies. So I just feel like for teachers, educators, administrators especially, I know we're always hard on administrators in the show, but it's like, if you're looking at this as a threat, then, you know, get ahead of it. Just figure out a new way to teach with this stuff. And if you can't, then maybe you deserve to be replaced, actually, right? I mean, if you're going to go all in with these vendors, they would prefer to do all the teaching with their applications and software. They would be happy to take that on. And if people just kind of like give in because they find something like technically complex or overwhelming, it's like, well, then the educators aren't doing a great job of educating themselves. So maybe these vendor dudes do have, you know, a feather in their cap to brag about. Just thoughts.
Yeah, I'm going to disagree with a whole bunch of that, but
please do.
That's what we do.
Yeah, man, for sure.
I don't think the teachers are getting replaced. I have listened. I read the articles in 1901. Right. It's use this technology instead of that technology. I read the articles in the 1920s about radio's going to replace teachers. I read the stuff in the 1950s that TV's going to replace teachers. In the 80s, it was computers. And then the 90s was the internet.
Well, and I'm saying, you know, this is talking to like the I'm sort of putting words in the mouths of, you know, what do you call it? The Pollyannas. The ones who are like, the sky is falling. Like the people who are like viscerally gnashing their teeth in the commentary about the AI stuff. I mean, 100%. Librarians aren't going anywhere. Teachers aren't going anywhere. In fact, teachers and librarians now more than ever. But if you're not giving people adequate training or resources because you're just giving them such shitty working conditions, then of course they're just going to be flying day to day, you know, hour to hour, because what else can they do, right? We completely as a society undervalue education from a monetary standpoint. And so hence people are going to be unprepared and they're going to have to come up with stuff ad hoc and improvise, which is what teachers are used to doing since the beginning of time, really.
Yeah, that's... Yeah, ad hoc and improvised. That is exactly it.
It's pretty punk rock, actually. Anyway.
Is it? Okay.
It is.
Cool. At some point, I'd like to have more conversation about that because I don't understand that at all, and I'm very interested.
It's like when somebody can pull together a play in front of the net, that ugly part in front of the net, right? They call it the swamp, right? You know, where you're liable to just get hit and whacked and... And then you can just, if you can get it in, you know, if it bounces off, you know, the guy in front of you and then off the pad and into the net, then swell. But it's a hard-fought victory, that's all. You know, it's like fighting in the swamp. That's another good metaphor.
Yeah. So with all this, when is enough enough? Like, I keep coming back to, when is enough enough? Why do we need the new innovation? I was at Nate, and one of the big tech companies named a building. They got their name on a building, and they got a contract that said every computer is going to be from our company. All right, so they became the vendor. And suddenly, everything had that. And I was in a group, and we were doing some stuff, and it's like, we need a Mac, because the Mac had better software for what we needed. And it was like, nope. No Macs. It has to have this other brand name on it, because we're done. So why are we pushing more and more onto it? It's like, and we know it's not good enough, but no, they've signed the contract. They named the building. They threw some money at us. And what are we going to do to help these students and teachers?
And to the effect too, right? Like, we kind of heap all this stuff on like administrators and people who have like the sort of at individual institutions, right? Like the top budgetary sign off. But I mean, in my experience, for instance, at Thompson Rivers, I was on the finance committee or whatever for the faculty. And what that involved is, I mean, it was like a we didn't have any authority, but we did have discretion to just ask questions. And one thing that really struck me is that with budgetary surplus, right, which was almost every year, because that's what the stewards of the public tax dollar do, due to, as I understand it, due to requirements by the ministry, right, the Ministry of Higher Ed or whatever they call it in BC, is that no surplus funds were permitted to go into programming, educational programming. It was only meant to go into infrastructure. So that's why you get buildings going up and condos on the endowment lands and whatnot, but you can't hire extra TAs, right? You can't get teaching support with that surplus. You can't just hire a bunch of people in programs that you're trying to grow to get them started up quickly. So, I mean, this really does go, this kind of issue that leads to these kinds of ruinous decisions really does go fundamentally up to the government level, the ministry. And those are the people that are elected. And education is never, ever, ever, ever a friggin' election issue whatsoever in this country, unless it's over some just parochial bullshit like we have in New Brunswick. But that's for another time. Anyway, man, it's like it goes all the way up. And the sad part is nobody cares, really. So.
And again, that's part of the problem. I see it as bigger than the ministry and the government. I see it as a societal issue.
Fair enough.
I just do, right? We live in a capitalist society, and money comes first, and everything else comes after that. So that's and this too much technology, too much, because you can slash a label on it. You can do some marketing with it and say, hey, look, we tried, and not deal with the actual symptom of what's going on.
Structural underlying issues. Nobody wants to touch it. So let's buy smart boards and clickers and then say we tried something original. Yeah. Well done. Well done, everybody. Let's go play golf. Jesus. Anyway, let's go play golf. Bro, is that the last one?
That was the last one. That was four.
Dang. And it's been over 40 minutes at this point.
Yep.
Okay. Well, in terms of the references, I think we had a pretty wholesome discussion there, pal. I don't know if I regret my, this brings up a lot of feeling. I think it brings up a lot of feeling in me. Clearly Erin, was motivated by an emotion when she shared this with you, and you in turn feel this too. I dare say, others, educators or whomever who may be checking this out, may have, I would suggest, some relatability to this topic, right? In some way. So I think this has been awesome, man. Do you want to jump into the word and phrase and question, or some of the pictures first?
Let's do some of the pictures. So if you go to the website, I don't know if you've ever seen, there's a meme that goes around in like the 1950s, the cover of a Batman comic, the picture is Batman slapping Robin. And people have grabbed that and made it into all these different memes. And one of them was, I didn't need a computer when I went to school. And then Batman slapped Robin and says, that was 40 years ago. I had that conversation with the head of school when I did my PhD. All the grad students at Edith Cowan and our faculty, they had two really nice computer labs. Right. And we like each had our own kind of study carol with a computer in it and blah, blah, blah. It was great little structure. And then they needed those rooms for something else. So they crammed us into whatever room was left. We didn't have a printer, right? The internet was spotty at best, all that kind of stuff. And all the rest of the grad students were international students. So I got volunteered because every time the international students went, they would kind of get brushed off with, oh, your English is broken. You don't understand the culture. So I showed up and they couldn't do that BS to me. Right? They just couldn't. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Right?
Institutions in Canada, I guess what you're describing in Australia, man, it's just like, we love the international students because we get to charge them twice as much and they're just grateful to be here and they don't speaky the Englishy enough to raise a complaint about shit, right? I mean, yeah. Not to be crass. Well, maybe I do mean to be crass. It's a crass thing. Again, at an institution that I used to work, there was this, at one point, this whole notion of like because the they had enrolled international students at a much higher, you know, level,
yes,
that they brought them in, that there was even room. So it was like, we're going to put up trailers for these students to live in because of the housing shortage in the city that this place was in. We're going to put up trailers. We're going to put up basically an international student ghetto on the campus. Like, it was madness. And it got shut down. I mean, thank God, just for various reasons, like the city just flat out said no. But still, I mean, it's just like, come on. You can't, nobody comes out of this looking good. So again, bro, sorry to kind of take away from your anecdote,
no.
But I mean, it sounds like that's the kind of deal, right? That kind of like just ruinous thinking and taking for granted people who are coming into your place with good faith and just marginalizing them while taking their dollars very happily. So,
oh yeah,
totally.
So my international grad student cohort wrote a letter, sent it to the head of school, and they like a bunch of them signed it. And it basically got rejected with, I don't understand what you're talking about, right? The English isn't very good. So they handed it to me and they said, could you rewrite this? And I could understand both their points. I didn't feel it was written as well as it could be. So I rewrote it. And after a career as being an educator, I could write.
Right.
And so
you're right, you could write.
Then I put my name on it as long as all the rest, then sent it off. And then I got a very official meeting with the head of school. And it's like, well, when I did my PhD in Oxford, and I'm like, what year was that? He's like, what do you mean? What difference does that make? I said, you got to handwrite your thesis, and then you gave it to somebody to type. I said, I have to print stuff out every day to give to my supervisor because the world has changed. So what year were you talking about? Like, is this... And it was like the early 1970s. And it's like, of course you got to handwrite it. We don't get to have that option. And our supervisors are demanding that they have printouts and email. So you're killing me here, man. And then magically a printer showed up. So at least we could print stuff out for people.
And that person gets to say, well, I was being a good steward of the public purse, right?
Yeah.
Made him beg for that damn printer. God.
Yeah, so it's one of those things. It's This is not the old days. We don't get to go back to chalkboards.
No.
We don't get to go back to all those things that people look back at when they were young and think how wonderful.
Or at least if you're going to have like a chalkboard-based learning institution, at least put it on the website, right? At least We have a chalkboard-based school here. Don't come here unless you want to use chalk and slate, because that's what we use because we feel it's the most effective. If you put it out clearly that that's your position, then fine, if you're being transparent. But then otherwise, people come in, you know, quite reasonably having an expectation of contemporary, you know, approaches to produce work that will meet the expectations in a contemporary professional and or academic setting. And if the disjuncture is there, then, I mean, whose fault is that, right? It's the person saying that they have something on offer, not the person who's taking up on what they think is a sincere and legitimate offer. So.
Yeah.
And then you got some other ones here, dude.
Is there any of those you'd like to talk to?
The gentleman with the hair. Do you know what I mean?
Why would technology do this? Yeah.
Very visually impactful.
So there's a meme out there where there's this is a talk show. Apparently, this was a talk show that survived for a while. And the host of the talk show has got a gun and is kind of shooting somebody in a chair. And so the students are the ones getting shot. The school is the one doing the shooting. And then he just turns to the camera and says, why would technology do this? It's like, it's not the technology doing it. The technology is just the latest tool being used to do this. Why are we abusing the students this way? It's just not. It doesn't respect their time. It doesn't respect their efforts. It doesn't respect the teacher's time and efforts or the best wishes for anybody.
It just take this prescription, take this silver bullet, and if it doesn't solve your problems, then just shut up. Just play dead if it doesn't solve your problems, because quite frankly, we have bigger problems than your problems, but you don't care because you're dead in the chair. Really? I mean,
that is it.
Quite a lot there, dude.
Yes. So, and it just becomes more and more and more. When can we say no? When can we say enough's enough? That's kind of the theme. So the word of the podcast is overload. I believe we are at overload.
I believe
not only have the technology, like if you go back to how people taught in the 60s and 70s and 80s and stuff, they did not have to do so much of this emotional intelligence counseling work as is happening now. Like that paradigm shift has happened, and let's dump technology on it. So it's just not respectful of people's times, and that's why the attrition rate for teachers is so low. Anyway, question of the podcast. How can we appraise all the impacts of technology?
Sorry, dude. I think you mean, I don't mean to be rude. I don't mean to jump in on you and barge in, but as a reformed English teacher, I think you mean teacher retention is so low because attrition is when people are ditching it, right? So you're talking about why we are retaining. Retention, just for my own, you know, cognitive disjuncture. That's all, Ro. Sorry. Please continue.
Oh, no worries. I was on a roll. I get on a roll. I like it when people are like, yeah, that was off. So I can straighten it out.
I was on a roll. I've been rolling. We're jelly rolling. Yeah, man. So,
if I'm on a sailboat headed for a rock and I don't notice, I am really happy when somebody says, hey, that's a rock. Let's turn. then I turn. It's okay.
Well, we could have fixed it with Camtasia. But anyway. Technology to the rescue, folks. God.
Yes. sorry, that makes me laugh. Yeah, Camtasia is wonderful for that.
Really is.
Anyway, question of the podcast. How can we appraise all the impacts of technology uses in education settings? So basically, when is too much too much? That's what we really need to get to. And then once we realize what's too much, how do we step back? How do we get back to something more reasonable that's going to help the students? And it's going to help more people do what they want in their lives and have better lives and that sort of thing. And there's phrases of the podcast, because I started with, don't expect that to be permanent, friends, because that was yours.
Okay.
And then you liked mine, like, you need to get a wooden stake and hammer it through the heart.
I can as the person who's in charge of finding a lot of the GIFs in the WordPress, I am here to tell you, friends, that if you scroll down on the bottom of this WordPress page, if that's where you're looking at this, I do recommend you go to the vampire staking GIF for further reference as to why this is such an effective turn of phrase for this particular topic. Awesome, man. So, geez, is that it? Are we actually done what we came here for, my friend?
Absolutely. Absolutely we are.
Geez, and it's even just about getting on the amount of time that would have ended the program, whether we were done talking about it or not. I actually think that, like any good dystopian film, this episode's going to deserve a sequel, my friend.
For sure.
You know, are you aware of the movie from the early aughts, 28 Days Later?
Yes.
Zombie film, survival film, Cillian Murphy's in it. It's an awesome film. Danny Boyle, right? Amazing British directors in charge of the franchise. And then about 10 years ago, how you look at it, they put out 28 Weeks Later. Well, as it turns out, Cillian Murphy's, the actor's next project, one of the next projects, I think he's teaming up with Danny Boyle again. They're doing 28 Years Later. So I just think that we might deserve a part two and even a part three to this particular thing. I know you sent me the Excel sheet with the topics. I haven't looked at it because you're the director and I am merely the executor of the WordPress stuff. But, you know, just putting it in your pipe there, pal, for consideration.
Oh, for sure.
Radical. So do we got anything else to say besides go Oilers?
We could say go Oilers, or we could say congratulations to you. You have some amazing people lined up for the Ed Nontech interview series.
I am stoked. My last week, there was one that kind of the scheduling got away from the person, and then my computer failed the day before I was meant to meet with another. But I have two people lined up for the next 5 days, people that took a lot of back and forthing to schedule with. They're awesome. I literally cannot wait. Doug, man, you can join us for those if you feel like it. I'll leave it up to you, but you know who they are, and boy, oh boy, I'm stoked. Thanks to these people in advance, who I will not name until the episodes are actually recorded. But yeah, man, it's going to be a good week, I think.
Oh, it sounds awesome.
Radical. Well, appreciate everybody checking it out, as always. Or I guess if this is your first time, thanks for coming. Hopefully you'll be back. And bye from me for now.
Bye for now. See you next time.
Until next time, friends.